Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with journalist and podcast host Christina Quinn. Her new series is called Fighting Crime. Fighting Crime dives into the world of crime, policy, and economics to uncover evidence of what actually works to improve public safety. From prisons and incarceration models to air pollution and crime and addiction recovery through GLP-1s, Christina Quinn's reporting in the series seeks to challenge you to think differently about criminal justice system as you know it. Christina Quinn is an award-winning multimedia journalist. Prior to Fighting Crime, she was host of Washington Post podcast Try This. She previously reported for WGBH Boston. Her stories have also aired on PBS NewsHour, NPR, PRA's The World, and BBC's World Service. Her work has won a New England Emmy and a regional Edward R. Murrow Awards. Christina Quinn, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom. Happy to be here.
Great to have you on. Great to have a fellow public radio person.
Yes, indeed. We love our member stations.
That's right. You know all the shorthand, so yeah.
I do.
We'll try not to get too insider here on the program today. Tell me a little bit about your past. Try This. Tell me just a little bit about that Washington Post podcast.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, the Try This, you know, we focused on sort of solutions to solve problems that we all share, very common problems, you know, from sleep to dopamine addiction. Everyone's sort of always in a doom scroll on their phones and sort of all kinds of really common things that we all sort of collectively have to tackle. And we just, the whole idea was to cut through the BS and help people wherever they are in short digestible episodes, similar to sort of what we're doing on Fighting Crime in terms of making sort of sometimes some tricky scientific stuff accessible for listeners.
What sorts of issues did you concentrate on in your reporting time with, say, you know, WGBH and others?
Sure. I mean, I've done it all, you know, in public radio, you often wear many hats, you know, news anchor, all that stuff. I did a lot of science and health reporting and tech reporting. But, you know, because it's public radio, you also have to go out and cover the storms.
Yeah.
we get our good share of storms out here in New England on the East Coast. So I've done it all. That sounds so obnoxious to say I've done it all, but that's sort of how it is. You know, when you're a journalist these days, you have to wear many, many hats. Yeah. So, but in terms of enterprise reporting, a lot of it would focus on, you know, sort of innovations in health and in public health issues and sort of how they intersect with technology and how it's continuously evolving.
Tell me about reporting, I guess, in public media, right? And then mm-hmm. podcast. Seems like everybody's got a podcast these days, but
yeah.
But I like to think of Ira Glass. You know, This American Life is the original podcast. Public radio,
yeah.
Kind of podcasty before it was more popular.
Right, you're absolutely right. I mean, I remember when podcasts were, you know, very much in the nascent age of the audio medium. I got to say, reporting, I think when you're reporting for public radio and for public television and for broadcast, you always have to have everything under a certain number of minutes, right? And so your reporting packages, usually, you know, if you have the luxury, can be 4 minutes long, maybe even 6.5 minutes long, but, you know, there's always a hard out, right? And so with podcasts, reporting for podcasts, I think the same stringent journalistic rules follow, but there's far more leeway and greater privilege in being able to expand on a topic. And that's, you know, something that I think a lot of people really enjoy, as, you know, to your point, that in the sense that there are like millions of podcasts out there now where people just get to talk and talk. So, yeah, I mean, really, at the end of the day, the biggest difference is the parameters and having hard ins and outs of a story. And yeah.
Let's move into concentrating on fighting crime. Why this topic? What do you want to accomplish with this series?
Yeah, I mean, this topic, when fighting crime, sort of we're looking at public safety, right? And sort of everybody can certainly agree that we want to have we want to live safer lives. We want to be in a safer society. Often those discussions become political very, very quickly, and they escalate into a level of discussion that can be hostile. And so when you factor in economics, when you factor in sort of the economic data that can support, how to make our society safer, that can sort of bring the temperature down around these discussions. And that's what really we're really hoping to do is to have discussions that look at, policies out there that can harm public safety measures or hurt and help. And I think some of the things that people think help are turns out to be they're counterintuitive. And sometimes the our best intentions don't necessarily pan out. And the other thing too is that there are so many great researchers out there looking at public safety and how we can take certain measures to improve that. But a lot of these studies are often wrapped up or tucked away in the pillars of academia, right? In the ivory towers. And we don't really hear much about it. But there's a lot of credence to what people are discovering and learning in that space.
What's missing in conversations around criminal justice in the mainstream media? I'm sure you're trying to fill those gaps. What's missing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of nuance that's missing. It's funny because I talked about data, and it's like, well, how is there room for nuance in data? But that's exactly it. I mean, when you have facts lined up to present a case, say for example, on how to help formerly incarcerated people find work, that really opens up the discussion because then you're actually like, hey guys, yeah, these are numbers, this is data, but behind all of these figures are people's lives. And it's, it's a small world. Like we all, we share this space together. And so if we all want to have, if we all sort of want to have a robust and safe society and economy, there are things that we can do to, in this particular case that I'm talking about, to help people who are leaving prison re-enter the world so they can join the workforce, which is actually what episode one of Fighting Crime focused on, was sort of, why is it so hard for people who serve time in prison to find work when they leave? I mean, the obvious answer is that, well, people, a lot of, potential employers don't really get excited about the prospect of hiring somebody who was in prison, right? There's just that stigma right there out of the gate. And so the thing is, though, is that around roughly 40,000 people leave prison in the US every year. And that's 40,000 people who are looking for work, who are looking to reset. And oftentimes, when they cannot find the work in order to start fresh, they have to return to a life of crime. And then, rinse and repeat, here we go again, right? And so, the more frequent someone returns to prison, the greater the burden is on the taxpayer. And so, this is like one of those conversations where you realize, like, oh no, we're all connected, right? We all we should all be part of this discussion. And so if we can highlight certain policies and practices that work, then let's do it.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Christina Quinn, the host of the new podcast series, the video series Fighting Crime. I assume you find this anywhere you find your podcast, Christina?
Absolutely, yes. And we also have it on YouTube as well.
All right. Let's talk a bit about episode one. Getting a job after serving time, employment, a lot of difficulties. We know for formerly incarcerated people to find jobs. You made reference, there are some obvious concerns employers have. Maybe we could flesh that out a little more.
Yeah, I mean, employers are just typically reluctant to hire people because they see it as a risk, right? It's like, well, am I hiring somebody who's going to, do something on the job? Are they going to commit a crime on the job? Right? Are they going to steal from me? Just these sort of, you know, there's this like, this is what a lot of employers think. Well, they, a lot of them may not want to say that out loud, but I think that's sort of, that's the going convention in terms of the why there's that stigma. So there's just that risk factor. And then, of course, when there's the risk of like, well, if a formerly incarcerated person is working for me and they do something while they're in, you know, their place of employment, while they're on the job, you know, perhaps a victim will then sue me as a business owner, right? And so there are a number of factors that could really deter somebody from even considering hiring a former convict.
Another thing that I was listening to episode one, by the way, that's out and available now, isn't it, episode one?
Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. We just launched the show last Thursday. So, yes, please, wherever you listen to your podcasts, Fighting Crime.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit about this, but encourage people to go and get the full episode wherever you get your podcasts, on YouTube as well. One of the things that stood out to me, something as simple as a person who's been serving time for a while, out of society, their skills are probably outdated. Life has passed them by a bit.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely something that I spoke with one man, Cosmarte, who served several years in prison for dealing drugs. And he served about 7 years, I think. And when he came out, well, I think 12 total. But when he came out, he told me this story where he got on the subway and he looked down, he looked at everybody and everybody was looking at their phones, and it really rattled him because when he had left for prison, smartphones were not ubiquitous. And so like just little moments, little observations like that can really sort of capture, you know, how much you've missed or how much, you know, you can miss when you're serving time in prison. So you're sort of completely, you know, isolated from advancements in technology. And as you know, technology is rapidly evolving every day, you know, something every month, we're always hearing something or reading something in the news where something new is happening in AI, something new is happening in some sort of smartphone technology. So when you're in prison, I mean, that's just one snapshot, but if you're serving a lot of time in prison, that's a lot of time that is not being spent on cultivating skills for the workforce, right? And so oftentimes when people are released, they don't have skills that are often in demand, or they're, you know, up to date in the technological space. And then, you know, add to that the stigma, and it can be really, really challenging. I mean, when I was speaking with Koss, when he was released from prison, he struggled for a long time finding work. Nobody wanted to hire him. He just thought he was, you know, it was just too risky. He had to do a lot of, you know, he had to work under the table just to make ends meet. But the thing is that while he was in prison, he did, he lost a lot of weight. He started doing essentially prison workouts. And while he was in prison, he helped a lot of his fellow inmates also get in shape. And so during that time, something sort of sparked. He's like, oh, I want to start a gym. Maybe this is something I can do. And so when he left prison, he had this dream, right? This dream has already sort of started to take form. And he wanted to help people get into shape like he got into shape in prison. And so the thing is, though, is that nobody would rent to him, right? Property owners didn't want to rent to him because you're a former convict. You have a record. And so he was scrappy. He would do classes in parks in the morning and in the evenings just to get, you know, get a following. And he did have a good following. And there was, fortunately, there was somebody who took a chance on him. I believe it was at Goodwill, just sort of doing some office work. And it was interesting, though, like during that whole experience, when he had applied for this job, he didn't check the box that said, you know, there's a lot of on job applications. There's the check this box if you have a criminal record. And he left it blank. And when his boss had confronted him about it, he's like, you know, to be honest, I don't really want to talk about it because it's such a long time ago. And I just want to move ahead with my life. Which, you know, I mean, it was sort of like shorthand for like, yes, I've served time, but I don't really want to, like, does that really, like, can we not make this part of the discussion since I'm doing the work, right? I'm showing up for work. I'm doing a good job. So we could talk about ban the box, but the point that I'm trying to make is that he was given a chance, and then a number of fortuitous things had happened in which a property owner who was renting out a space also gave him a chance on renting out a space. It was actually a woman who had like a sort of a Buddhist prayer center. And then, so like on the other side of it, he opened up his gym called Khan Body. And as the name implies, Khan stands for ex-convict. And he was, you know, conducting his classes, in this building in New York. And long, just to sort of, you know, that was the beginning of his growing enterprise. I mean, Khan Body is now a really successful gym in Lower Manhattan, and it's really cool. I was there, and you show up, and like he really leans into the prison aesthetic. So like the door to the studio looks like a prison door. The lockers are really small. It's really cool, and he does amazing workouts. I went to one of his classes, and yes, there is no room for whining or complaining in his workouts.
I can imagine. Yeah, Kos, quite a character. If you listen to the urge people to go and listen to the or view the episode here, episode one of Fighting Crime. Just one more thing, and then yes, following a break, I do want to talk about Ban the Box. A reason to, you know, follow the research, because it's surprising results, the research about Ban the Box. But I guess this illustrates an overall point I'm sure you're, you know, underlining in this episode, which is Kos really wanted to go straight. He didn't want to go back to dealing drugs.
He did not want to go back.
He had a dream, but, you know, you got to give him a chance.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly it, is that there are these people who are leaving prison, they really want to start fresh. Nobody wants to go back to prison. And you know, thanks to a couple of people who did take a chance on him, he was able to, you know, essentially make his dreams come true, right? He started his gym, he opened up his gym, and people just have to have a little faith.
We're talking with Christina Quinn, host of the new video podcast series. It's called Fighting Crime. And you can find that wherever you find your podcasts, on YouTube as well. We're talking about it on the program today more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with journalist and podcast host Christina Quinn. Her new series is called Fighting Crime. Fighting Crime dives into the world of crime, policy, and economics to uncover evidence what actually works to improve public safety. Episode 1 is out now. You can find that wherever you find your podcast, the video series on YouTube as well. So Christina Quinn, we mentioned Ban the Box. We were talking about a person like Kos, who is a formerly incarcerated person. These folks are well familiar with the box, which is that little box that you have to check or not check. Have you previously been convicted of a crime? Employers want to know. But I guess there is a movement, and some places have tried this. Let's get rid of that question. So what happened? What did the evidence show?
Well, yes. So Ban the Box is often on many job applications. If you tick it off, you're letting employers know that you had some sort of interaction with the criminal justice system, right? And the idea is that by banning this actual box, it will increase the chances that a potential employer will hire somebody who has served time, because the option of entertaining that stigma is taken out of the equation, right? So about 36 states have tried a version of this policy, and, you know, which prohibits employers from asking about criminal records. and criminal record histories during the initial job application, during the initial stage of the process. They can still do background checks, but that happens later on in the hiring process. So this just sort of is the idea behind Ban the Box, is to like, let's take that, take this question out of the equation, because we want to give everybody an equal fighting chance. And it is worth noting, though, that Ban the Box policies have only really applied to public employers, but there are some states and cities where they have extended these policies to private employers. But it turns out that Ban the Box did not prove to be as beneficial as I think a lot of lawmakers had hoped that it would, or the people that, you know, who had implemented this policy hoped that it would. So that's what was really, I think, fascinating, is that, so I spoke with Amanda Agin, who is an economist over at Cornell. Let me make sure I got that right. Amanda Agin is an economist at Cornell, and she spoke to me about how Ban the Box and policies like Ban the Box and sealing criminal records doesn't really help people get jobs. And a lot of it comes down to a number of things. So she actually wrote a paper called Ban the Box, Criminal Records and Racial Discrimination, a Field Experiment. So this actually included, they really did look at, it's a randomized control study, which is really important. That's something that we also make sure to include as much as possible in fighting crime, because, you know, it's a scientifically proven study that indicates in this particular case that Ban the Box policies, and here they focus specifically on like jurisdictions in New Jersey and New York City, and how employers reacted to different types of applicants. And so, of course, employers prefer candidates without criminal records. But what was interesting is that employers were significantly, you know, yes, they were like less likely to call back an applicant that had a criminal record. But the really the biggest takeaway is that it was the racial differences in callback rates. So before Ban the Box, you know, whether or not you had a criminal record, there was actually no difference in callback rates by race before Ban the Box was implemented. So that meant that essentially employers treated white and black job applicants with criminal records very similarly. It was the same, similar rate. Okay. Now, after Ban the Box was put in place, the rate of callbacks for white applicants was much higher than for black applicants. And these are people who had similar backgrounds. They had similar backgrounds, job education, experience, histories, same, you know, sort of like they grew up in similar neighborhoods. We're talking about like socioeconomic backgrounds. But what happened was once employers stopped asking about criminal record histories, they still tend to prefer to hire or call back white job applicants. And so the biggest takeaway was like, wow, so this isn't actually like, sure, employers don't want to hire ex-convicts, but there is this bias there that they would call back white applicants. And that was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Unexpected. So what about record expungement? It seems like that maybe that would help formerly incarcerated people to get jobs at a higher rate.
Well, that's also interesting. You would think that's the case, but it turns out that it's not necessarily an effective approach to hiring ex-convicts. So, you know, if you're sealing records, which some jurisdictions have implemented, but the thing is that at the end of the day, employers really do want to know about someone's criminal record. And so, Amanda Agin over at Cornell, they looked at sort of what happens when you take that out of the equation. So if somebody's criminal history information disappears after 7 years, What happens? Well, it turns out employers are still not hiring, these people. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that there's just sort of this gap, right? There's this gap on the resume. And so that doesn't help anyone either. So if the gap is unexplained, then you don't really, like, they're not going to be interested in reaching out to you. And so it turns out that people actually, employers do want to, like, they actually do want to know. And maybe in some cases, they didn't even know that they wanted to know until now that we see the data that supports the fact that, like, oh, actually, the more you know, the better. And therefore, you could maybe even be willing to take a chance. But yeah, that's a... I think when I talk about all these things, like, we discuss sort of nuance, right? And that's what's really interesting behind all of these studies, is that it sort of taps into a lot of implicit biases that we carry as people. And it also taps into sort of like the social psychology component of what people think could be helpful. And then it turns out at the end of the day, we actually do want to know more than we maybe initially thought.
So in this episode one, which is by the way, is out and available now, Fighting Crime, on wherever you get your podcast and on YouTube, you do explore some things that seem to be working. What works?
Yeah. So I spoke with a labor market economist over at Harvard Business School. Her name is Zoe Cullen, and she studies a lot of inequality in the labor market. And insurance, providing insurance to employers, is actually a pretty effective approach to incentivizing employers to hire formerly incarcerated people. So, yeah, so that was something that I think a lot of people, when I'm talking to like people about this, like, they didn't even know like that providing insurance is something that like is what we should be discussing, you know, because that's, and so in this particular study, you know, the idea is that if this insurance were provided, you know, there were government funding behind this, that sort of buttresses employers' confidence in hiring somebody, because it's like, well, you know, if I'm insured, should anything happen while this person's on the job and my business takes a hit, I have insurance that will help me recover the costs, you know, if this person I hired is committed a crime. But what was really interesting is that it wasn't even a huge amount, like a large, sort of like large amount of money to cover as part of the insurance coverage wasn't even necessary. It turns out that just like a small amount, just having like $5,000, in insurance just to cover any potential losses is really all that employers needed to feel motivated to hire somebody who had served time. And that, when you think about that sort of like, you take a step back, big picture, it's like, well, that's a pretty small amount of money. When you're thinking in the larger sense of sort of like what can be done to, you know, like when we're thinking of like having these sort of like philosophical discussions in terms of like, and even like more practical conversations about how we can invest in people who are trying to re-enter the workforce, because at the end of the day, the more people who stay out of prison, the more taxpayer money we save.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Christina Quinn. She's host of the new series Fighting Crime. You can find it wherever you find your podcast and on YouTube. We've been talking about episode one, how to improve chances for formerly incarcerated people to find employment. Let's move to talking about episode two. That'll be coming out in, what, a week or two. And you visit a Scandinavia-style prison. Of course, yeah. Immediately you say Scandinavian-style prison, and people sort themselves across the divide, right? If you're a if you're a tough on crime person, you're going to roll your eyes. If you're right. A little more liberal on that, you're maybe wanting to learn more about this. But you're trying to get the evidence. Does this actually work? Tell me about this.
Yeah, so I went to a prison right outside of Philly. It's called the Chester Correctional Facility, about 30 minutes away from Philly, and you know, this is a prison. They've got, I think, about 13,000 people there. And I could be wrong. Actually, no, 13,000 sounds massive. Sorry, I'm thinking of 13,000 square feet. In any case, Tom, I went to this prison, and they're doing this experiment there in which they are taking the Scandinavian prison model, and they applied it to one unit inside this prison. Now, when I went to Chester, in order to get a real sense of sort of like, well, what does a Scandinavian prison unit look like? They walked me through a general population unit first. And so have you ever been to prison, Tom?
Never have, no. Mm.
Okay. So let me give you a sense of what it was like. So it's really like in order to go from one space to another, and granted, I was walking through with the assistant to the superintendent and a correctional officer, you can't leave one room without the door behind you closing first. So I get to the general population unit, and it was interesting. Like, everyone kept warning me about like, oh, you're going to notice the smell. Like, it just smells weird and it smells bad. And I was like, okay. So I was sort of bracing myself. We get to this unit, and I mean, the first thing I notice is that the lights are sort of, they're really bright. It's like that harsh fluorescent lighting, but it's also sort of weirdly dim. It's kind of like an odd dichotomy, but that's sort of like, it's harsh but dim. And there's just an energy in the air that isn't comfortable. Everyone's sort of on edge. And it's also really loud because of the way that it's the floor plan is laid out, right? There are two floors, and the correctional officer sits in the middle of the unit. And so she could keep an eye on everybody, right? So it's sort of like a circular space. She can keep an eye all around her, a panoramic view. But the inverse is true, right? Everyone else can see her. So like, everyone's just sort of on display all day long. And the smell that everyone kept warning me about had to do with the fact that there was a distinct smell and I couldn't identify it. And it turns out it's the smell of drugs. And I don't know if you read this story in the New York Times that came out a couple of months ago, but drugs are getting easily smuggled into prisons because they prisoners, they're able to like soak paper in synthetic drugs. And then that paper is then smuggled in into these units. And then once they're inside, the prisoners will light the paper and then get high off of that. And so there's a distinct smell to it. And so that was sort of what was hanging in the air. And if you work there day in and day out, that's something that you're very, very familiar with. And it's, I think for people who are staff, who are correctional officers, it's like you also, you're like, oh, am I inhaling this stuff too, right? So I'm in this general population unit. It's all metal furniture that's bolted to the floor in the main area. So you've got tables and chairs, they're all bolted to the floor. And yeah, it's just not a great atmosphere. Of course it isn't. It's prison. Prison is not designed to be a welcoming place, right? And it's also worth mentioning that there are two people assigned to every cell. So you have two people sharing a room, it's a bunk bed, and there's a toilet in the corner. Now, I leave that general population unit and they say, let's go to Little Scandinavia. And so I'm like, okay. So we go to Little Scandinavia, which is just around the corner. And first of all, before I even enter the unit, there's a mural on the wall that says like, welcome to Little Scandinavia. And it's like this beautiful airbrush mural with like the globe, our planet Earth. And then the first thing I noticed though when they opened the door was the smell of food cooking, because Little Scandinavia has a kitchen inside. And there was this gorgeous fish tank inside that was like immaculate. It was like so well kept. And there are houseplants in Little Scandinavia. And I felt like I was walking, I was just like a completely different energy in the air, far more relaxed and just not tense. There was like no tension in the air. And I could go on. I mean, like the lighting is softer, the color of the paint on the walls is a little softer, the furniture is not bolted to the floor, there's soft seating. There was gym equipment, there was a pool table. I mean, it now kind of sounds like I'm describing a bachelor pad, but the immediate differences, I mean, I've noticed them upon walking in, right? It just sort of like really hits you in the face.
So what does the research say? Is this effective? How do we measure it?
Right. So, I mean, there are studies happening. There's a study happening right now. So, you know, you've got Drexel University who teamed up with researchers in Oslo to see, like, is it possible that having a prison unit that has, you know, a more comfortable living environment, could that do a couple of things? Could it help inmates who are leaving, who will eventually leave, re-enter the real world, feeling a little bit more prepared? Because bear in mind, a lot of these people, when they enter prison, at the start of their sentences, they're young. In this case, they're young men, right? And they maybe didn't know how to cook for themselves. They didn't know how to balance a budget, put together a grocery list. In Little Scandinavia, because there's a kitchen, these guys are learning how to cook. And, you know, I was, you know, getting the tour of this unit by a correctional officer named Paige Devane. And she, I mean, for her, the just having that, being able to sort of have a rapport with inmates is also unique, because in prison, correctional officers are not supposed to be chummy with inmates. And in Little Scandinavia, it's worth noting that inmates are called residents. They're not called inmates. And they're encouraged to have a good rapport with correctional officers. And the idea is there is that the correctional officer is there to help facilitate your reentry into the real world. So when I was speaking with Paige, you know, she was talking to one of the residents. I won't say inmate, because in Little Scandinavia, they're residents. And she had been helping him. Like, I think he was taking like a statistics course or something. He was trying to get his degree at a local university. And there was one particular course that he was really struggling in. And he credited her for helping him sort of get through that class. And so the correctional officer and inmate relationship in Little Scandinavia, and it's, you know, based on the Scandinavian model, it's different. It's more of like a mentor-mentee relationship, which is very, very different from the status quo here in American prisons. Now, you would ask me sort of like, well, what are they seeing? I mean, it's still too early, even out of Sweden and Norway, to see what this model can do for inmates when they leave. I mean, they're doing this research as we speak, but they're hoping that it could also reduce recidivism. You know, if you're essentially treated with dignity while you're in prison, if you're treated, you know, if you're given the opportunity to cultivate skills like cooking and doing stuff like that, then maybe you'll be better prepared to reenter the world and won't recommit a crime. Do we know that yet? No, we don't know. But the idea is they're hoping that is the case. But it's also worth noting that these inmates or residents in Little Scandinavia, now this unit has been there for about 5 years now, and they have only had during that time one incident in which two inmates got into a verbal argument, and it was a disagreement. Whereas in the general population unit, when I was speaking with the correctional officer, Paige Devane, she's like, when I would come into work, you know, there would always be sort of like a brief before the shift started, like, oh, you have to keep an eye on these two over here. There was always something going on, because in a general population unit, it is such a different environment. It's very much a fight or flight response. People are sort of always, you always have to be on guard, always on alert, because anything could happen. And it's not an environment that's conducive to a lot of self-reflection. Whereas this is based on, you know, when I was speaking with one particular inmate named Lewis, he was saying just having your own cell is incredible. He's like, you know, for him, he's like, I'm able to focus on my studies. He's like, whereas in Gen Pop, that wouldn't necessarily be the case if I was sharing a room with somebody who had absolutely no interest in bettering their lives. And so just having a space to yourself and being able to be alone with your thoughts is something that obviously, you know, you and I probably take for granted. But if you're serving decades for a crime you committed in prison, it's priceless. So we don't really know yet what the long-term effects of something like this will be, but it doesn't sound like a terrible idea, right? Having just basically being treated with a little bit more dignity in prison. That said, our prisons are overpopulated. They're overcrowded. The idea of having two people or having one person, one cell to one person, I think for a lot of lawmakers and for a lot of, people who are running these prisons are like, how on earth is this something that can be replicated, right? Like, it's hard to get funding for prisons to begin with. And so it's a really unique idea. And there are, I think there'll be more prisons that are going to be trying this experiment out. We have to just wait a little longer to see.
Let's take another break. Come back with more. We're talking with Christina Quinn, host of the new podcast video series, Fighting Crime. That's anywhere you find your podcast on YouTube as well. Following a break, we'll maybe answer a couple of questions. For example, does DNA really stop crime? More following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with award-winning multimedia journalist Christina Quinn. She's host of the new podcast series, Fighting Crime. You can find it anywhere you get your podcast, on YouTube as well. So Christina Quinn, some questions you delve into in the series. By the way, episode one is out. Episode two is coming out in a couple of weeks. Does DNA really stop crime? You look at DNA. Tell me just briefly about this.
Right. So we're looking at sort of how DNA technology is evolving. That's definitely one component to this episode that will be coming down the pipeline next month, or this month, actually. Happy June. But DNA is sort of the gold standard, right, when it comes to solving crimes, forensic DNA, right? Cold cases have been solved thanks to DNA. But it is a technology where there's still so much more potential, and with that, so much that we don't know. Rapid DNA is something that is becoming more widely adopted in the initial stages of investigations, of criminal investigations. And so when it comes to the typical DNA, forensic DNA analysis process, that can take several weeks, right? Because you have to, DNA is complicated. You want to make sure, you need to be accurate, right? And so the process, when you send DNA samples off to a lab from a crime scene, it could be weeks until you get results. Rapid DNA allows investigators to do some pretty critical things in the first 48 hours after a crime has been committed. And it can oftentimes help identify suspects or rule out suspects, right? Just in terms of getting a sense of who was at the crime scene. And this is in the initial state, the initial sense, right? Of course, you want to, the samples are typically then sent to the forensics lab for the more robust DNA analysis. But rapid DNA technology is one of those things that that a lot of law enforcement agencies are hoping could help them essentially expedite an investigation. And so that's sort of where things are going right now. And it's pretty fascinating to see. But in terms of using DNA as a crime prevention tool, that is also a pretty exciting and potentially polarizing topic, right? Because people think, well, DNA, that's my personal information. Why should my DNA be in a database if I've never committed a crime? And so there's one particular study that we look at in this episode. And it was actually a study helmed by Jennifer Doliak, who is an economist for Arnold Ventures. And Arnold Ventures is behind this, behind Fighting Crime. And essentially she looked at data where in Denmark, there was this huge policy change that happened back in 2005. And so essentially, people who had committed a crime in Denmark, you were only added to a criminal database if you'd been charged of a very serious offense and if DNA was relevant to that particular case. But in 2005, that all changed. Anyone who was charged with an offense with a maximum penalty of 18 months or so were then automatically added into a DNA database. Now, it's worth noting that in the US, only 19 states, is it allowed where somebody who is arrested for a felony, their DNA is taken upon that arrest. So your cheek is swabbed. Okay. And, but that's only the practice in 19 states here in the US. So I just want to give you that information for context. But in Denmark, after this law passed in 2005, anyone charged with an offense that would carry a sentence of 18 months and so on were automatically added to this database. And the purpose of the study was to see that if you were added to a database, would it prevent you from reoffending? Because you know that your DNA is out there. So if you commit a crime again and, you know, they collect evidence at the crime scene and your DNA is there, it's going to, you know, that's it. You're going to be busted. And it turns out that this DNA database in Denmark proved to be very effective. I don't want to give too much away, but it was very effective in discouraging people from recommitting crimes, from reoffending. And I'm just going to say, like, a DNA database that had people who had a criminal record were 40% less likely to reoffend, which is a pretty staggering figure when you think about that. Like 40% were less likely to commit a crime, which, you know, when you look at that figure, it's kind of like hard to argue with making the case for having a DNA database. But the idea of a DNA database opens up a lot of concerns around privacy, right? I mean, Tom, would you want to have your DNA in a database?
No, I don't. So, yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah. Well, we're at the end of our time here. Fascinating. I'll just mention a couple other questions that are asked and answered in this series to pique a listener's interest. Why might GLP-1s or other weight loss drugs help improve public safety? That'd be a fascinating episode. And how might air pollution be making crime worse? Another fascinating topic covered in this series. We're talking about the new series, Fighting Crime. You can find that anywhere you get your podcast. It's on YouTube as well. And we've been talking with the host of the podcast, Christina Quinn. Christina Quinn, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.